Humans think one way, animals think another way. And so we ask, can animals be worked more humanely if we think like animals?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,108th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Buenos Aires who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby. Hello, Jason.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, Jason, you are a vegetarian.
Yes.
You know, of course, by being a vegetarian, you are depriving some animals of the opportunity to experience life.
I never thought about it like that.
Well, what you probably do think of it as is you don't want to hurt animals. Is that right?
Sure. Yeah.
And you probably think you don't want to hurt the environment, right?
No, I wouldn't want to do that either.
Okay, I want you to hold on to those two objections, one in each fist, and hold them really tight, okay?
Okay.
Got it? All right. Folks, I learned to move cattle from Montana cowboys, some of which were well-practiced in the ways of the wild, wild west. Hee-ah! They'd yell at the cattle to get them on the move. Hee-ah! Hup, hup! And to emphasize who was boss, they'd whack the slow movers on the butt with their coiled-up ropes. Hee-ah! Move along, little doggy! Of course, not all the cattle liked the way in which the dominion was being taken over them. Some of them would slip away to hide in the brush and force the cowboys to chase them around the brush, and all the while the cowboys would be cursing in their best cowboy manner. I never thought much about the wild, wild west way of moving cattle. How else do you move a reluctant critter that weighs well over half a ton? But then along comes Dr. Temple Grandin, who says, "Stop yelling! If you start thinking like an animal, you'll be able to move cattle with a shh, shh, shh." The thought of whispering cattle to where you want them to go leads us to ask, can animals be worked more humanely if we think like animals? And who better to ask than Dr. Temple Grandin, professor of animal science at Colorado State University and the author of the just-released Working with Farm Animals. Dr. Temple, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Well, it's great to be here today.
Great to have you with us. You know, you last were with us on Food Chain Radio number 952, which is over 3 years ago. And you now are responsible for having designed over half the animal processing facilities in the United States and Canada. I'm just wondering why it's taking you so long to get them all designed.
Well, design is only half the equation. When I first started my career back in the early 70s, I thought if I could just build the right system, everything's going to be wonderful. Equipment is half of it. The other half of it is good management. And where I saw some of the greatest changes is when people improve their management. The first thing that people have to do in handling animals is to calm down. A scared, frightened animal is much more difficult to handle.
And well, who's the most frightened?
Well, usually it's the animals. People yelling and screaming and makes the heart rate go way up, makes cortisol, the stress hormones go way up. So people need to calm down. And then when they calm down, they can start learning some other things about stockmanship.
So the first step is stop yelling.
You have to calm down. You've got to stop flapping your arms, hitting animals, and calm down. And when you do that, then there's many, many, many other things that you can learn. But you've got to calm down first. Mm-hmm. And I get asked all the time what helped me in understanding animals. And I'm a visual thinker. I don't think in words. I know a lot of radio people probably think in words, but I think in pictures. So the very first thing I looked at was to see what the animals were afraid of in the chutes. They would stop at a coat on a fence. Stop at a reflection on water on the floor, or there's a hose on the floor, or a vehicle parked by a facility. Things we tend to not notice. And other people hadn't thought to look at what animals were seeing going through a facility. And I always get asked all the time, and they're afraid of getting slaughtered, I found their behavior is exactly the same on the farm as it is at the slaughterhouse. And they're scared of the same things. And the stress levels, if you look at them, are about the same in both places. They can range from high to really low.
That's very interesting. Now, when you first started doing this, there were not a lot of people doing this. So I wonder what, for those people who do not know you, Dr. Temple, what was it about you that allowed you to see things that frightened animals that the rest of us simply did not see or would not see or refuse to see?
Well, I'm a total visual thinker. Everything I think about, I see in pictures. And when I was talking about the coat on a fence, I'm seeing a picture I took back in the 70s for the Arizona Farmer Rancher magazine of a coat on a fence. And a bunch of cattle came up and looked at it and sniffed at it. Now, if you have that on the side of the chute, they're going to stop. And when you're working the cattle, I don't really want to wait, 10 minutes for them to sniff at it. Then they finally will move on by it. The best thing to do is just to remove the coat. And what I've learned is a lot of people, thinking words tend to not see it. Different people think different ways. Some people are mathematicians. They're really good at mathematical things. But I'm good at visual things. So it was obvious to me to look at what cattle were seeing. Look at where are their ears pointing. They'll point their ears right towards stuff that concerns them.
So they're actually telling you, if you watch them and listen to them, they'll actually tell you what's the problem.
They will show you the problem. In fact, in the book, Working with Farm Animals, got lots of beautiful colored pictures showing animals watching things with their ears, pointing them in all different directions.
The last time we talked, we broached the subject of taking dominion. The good Lord has given us dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth. And so a lot of us, take that command, that privilege and say, well, why should we care? We're the boss. Why should we care about what the animals feel or think, or who cares about them?
Well, first of all, that word dominion, I went on a trip to Israel and I asked about 10 people in Israel what that word means in Hebrew, and it means stewardship. Has a little bit different meaning. And I asked a whole lot of people. That has a kind of a different meaning than dominion. You've got to remember the Bible's been translated. Now, I've done a lot of thinking about, the use of animals. And one of the things I learned just a couple of years ago is that the very best soils in Iowa and Illinois, the very best black soil was created by herds of grazing animals, the bison. Grazing animals actually a part of the land. We've got huge amounts of land in the U.S., the outback of Australia, and in other countries that's very arid land. You cannot crop this land. You will deplete the water supply if you do that. And the only way you can raise food on that land is grazing animals of various kinds. And I just was reading a really nice paper yesterday on some work with mixed grazing, where when you put the sheep and the cattle together on the pasture, if you do it right, that can improve the land even more. They're part of the land. And when you look at sustainability, monocultures of soy are not exactly the most sustainable thing. What we need to be doing is getting into crop rotation and getting the animals back in as part of that crop rotation and using their natural fertilizer.
At the beginning of the show, I was giving our producer, Jason Struby, a bad time because as a vegetarian, he is depriving some animals of the opportunity to experience life. But he's also depriving people of the opportunity to use those animals to regenerate our earth, our soil.
Well, the animals are part of the soil. I'm a big believer in going across disciplines. And our animal science department here at Colorado State had the wisdom of inviting a crop scientist to our livestock symposium that we do for international students. And this livestock scientist explained how the very best soils were created. And I have to admit that up until 2 years ago, I did not know that, because we don't usually have crop scientists at our livestock symposium. And I thought that was one of the most important talks I had gone to. I hadn't thought about that. The animals make the land. They're part of the land. Now, you can do grazing wrong, and you do grazing wrong, it wrecks the land. I've seen that. I've seen overgrazing. It's ruined land. But you do animals right, and they can improve the land. They're part of the land. You know, it gets down to doing things right. And I get asked all the time about what is sustainability. I think sometimes it's easier to define sustainability by what it's not. We can all agree that fishing out the fishery is not sustainable, that depleting an aquifer that doesn't replenish, which is literally mining water, is not sustainable, letting a large farm operation just dump manure in the river is not sustainable. We can all agree on that. And the first step is you've got to stop that kind of stuff.
And the next thing we can agree on is to all hang on to our seats, because Temple Grandin is going to be right back after these short messages. And we're going to talk about what it is to handle animals in a way that's humane, simply by thinking like animals. Never thought of that before. Thinking about it now. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Dr. Temple Grandin and you.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Dr. Temple Grandin. She, the professor of animal science at the Colorado State University, the author of the brand new book, Working with Farm Animals, and also she is the principal designer of half of the nation's animal processing facilities. And her career started back in the 1970s. And, you know, there are a few people that really change things. And Dr. Temple is one person that has really changed animal agriculture here in the United States. And, you know, done it in a way that makes so much sense. Now, I come from a time and a place where, you know, when you moved cattle, you moved them. Get along, little doggy. But Dr. Temple Grandin has figured out that by thinking like animals, you can move them much more efficiently than if you think like a person. So I'd like to go start right there with Dr. Grandin, if we can. What is the difference between how animals think and how people think?
Animals are sensory-based thinkers. They think in pictures. They think in sounds. They think in smells. They think in touch sensations. It's not word-based. You need to get away from words. And in my book, Temple Grandin's Guide to Working with Farm Animals, I have lots of diagrams to show you how to work the animal's flight zone. A lot of people find the diagrams really helpful. If you have a completely tame animal, then you just lead it. In fact, one of the problems you get with a completely tame animal is they get pushing and shoving on them, and then you need to teach them that, you know, that if you're going to open the gate, they're going to have to stand still and open the gate, not have you be pushing and shoving. But other cattle, especially in the more extensive areas of the West, are going to have some flight zone. And when you enter the flight zone, the animal's going to move away. And if you have an animal confined in a chute and he's getting excited and jumping around, then you need to back up and get out of the flight zone. Mm-hmm. There's also the point of balance of the shoulder. And there's some natural behaviors that cattle have that are kind of counterintuitive. If you have animals lined up in a chute, you know, to go in for vaccinations or even at the meat plant, a real simple way to get them to move forward is to quickly walk back past them, real close to them, past the shoulder, the point of balance, and they'll move forward. Sounds counterintuitive, but it works. Mm-hmm. That often stands better than, works better than just standing behind them. The mistake that people want to avoid is to stand at the head of the animal and poke it on the butt. But understanding some of the behavioral principles can really help you out. And it's all outlined, easy to use pictures and diagrams in Temple Grandin's Guide to Working with Farm Animals. It's available at independent bookstores. It's available on Amazon. I think that will help you understand your cattle.
Well,
and your sheep. We got lots of sheep in there, too.
That's right. And it's, you know what? In reading your book, which I did last night, I sat down and went through the whole thing. I'm reminded of the lessons I learned in Aikido, where you're in a confrontation with somebody, but nobody ever gets hurt, and everybody kind of goes away smiling. But and it's, I guess that really picked up on the whole notion with the point of balance in an animal. So you're working with critters that can weigh, you know, three quarters of a ton. And when you talk about the point of balance, what exactly are you talking about, the point of balance?
Well, it's a natural behavior that's like hardwired into the animal. And if you're up really, really close to it, if you're behind the point of balance, they go forward. And if you're in front of the point of balance, they're going to go backward. And if you're out on pasture and you get someone a distance away, point of balance can change some. But when you're working right up close to them in a chute, where they're in a single file chute, maybe you're going for vaccinations, if you quickly walk back by that point of balance, they will go forward. It is a hardwired behavior. You know, another hardwired behavior that cattle have is when they fight, they butt each other, where horses will rear up and flail at each other. That is a hardwired behavior pattern. And if you understand the behavior patterns, it can really help you. Now, I know a lot of people on small farms are going to get really tame animals, and they can get really pushy and dangerous because they do weigh so much. So it's really important, if you have really tame cattle, to teach them polite behavior. If they're mobbing and pushing, you don't open the gate. You wait until they stand still, and then you open the gate. If they want a treat from you or they want their back scratched, have them stand still, and then you give it to them. They lean on it, then you stop scratching them. They need to learn to have manners. And it's very, very easy to teach tame cattle manners. But then bulls can be a problem.
Well, that was one of the most enjoyable pieces of your book, was the story about bulls and their behavior patterns. And there's a difference, a fundamental difference between the bull's behavior and determined by how they are raised, correct?
Well, that's right. That's right. You see, cattle, when they get to be, sexually mature, the bulls are going to decide they got to go out and fight who's going to be the boss and be the man of the herd and all that kind of stuff. Now, you want bulls, calves, growing up with other bulls, growing up with other cattle. So they learn their cattle. So if you want to have a tame bull that's reasonably safe, you want to rear it on a cow, growing up with the cows. Now, problems with bulls attacking people is not a tameness issue. It's mistaken identity. Because the most dangerous bull calf is the one you rear in a little pen by himself. And then when he gets sexually mature, he attacks you rather than other cattle. And that can have deadly consequences.
Now, let's back up and explain that. Dr. Temple, would you back up and explain that just a little bit here? So when you have a bull that has been raised on a bottle by a person, it identifies with a person.
That's right. It identifies with the person. And then when it grows up, instead of attacking other cattle, they determine who is boss and who's the man. It attacks people. So the best way to have a safe bull is to, you can, when it's really tiny, you can raise it on the bottle, but then get it in with pens of other cattle. So it grows up learning that it's cattle. Now, this is strictly a bull thing. Female cattle, no problem. Cows, no problem. Ewes, no problem. Steers, no problem. If you choose to make a steer out of it, that just eliminates the problem completely. It is definitely a guy thing. And the number one cause of fatalities, unfortunately, is bulls. And some of these hand-reared pets are the worst. It's not tameness. So if you're showing bulls and you're showing them at halter, you want to have that bull calf reared in with other cattle. So he learns he's cattle. And we're just the benevolent butt scratchers and feed giver elders. And another thing that people don't recognize is that there's a hardwired behavior that a bull does before he attacks. And most people don't know this behavior. It's called the broadside threat. We all know what a bull is going to be bad when he lowers his head and paws the ground. But before he does that, he'll turn sideways towards another animal or a person and hunch up his neck and show you how big and bad he is. That's a broadside threat. And bulls that do that display towards people can be extremely dangerous. And the best way to prevent this problem is taking young bull calves, rearing them on a cow, or if you do bottle feed it, it needs to be in with pens of other cattle. Or the best thing, the safest thing to do is just make a steer out of it when you have an orphan bull calf. Mm-hmm. And the cows, the heifers, they're no problem.
You know, I was reminded of being a kid in Yellowstone Park and watching a tourist. I can remember him because he had yellow Bermuda shorts on and a Hawaiian shirt and a camera. And he walked out into a meadow to photograph a big bull moose. And the closer, we were all sitting in our car going, goodness, what is he doing? But the closer he got to the bull moose pretty much displayed exactly the same, you know, characteristics you just talked about. He turned broadside and he looked huge. And this guy kept getting close with his camera and the bull turned and he lowered his head. And by the time the guy figured out that the bull was going to charge, the bull was charging, the bull moose. And this guy made the most exquisite flight across the pasture that you've ever seen, somehow making it back in one piece. But there it is. He was thinking like a person and not thinking so like the guy.
That's right. And this bull behavior is completely explained in the guide to working with farm animals.
The other thing,
and there's also some good tips in there on simple ways to build facilities. I've designed a lot of big facilities. The Guide to Farm Animals has designed much simpler facilities for people that might have 10 head of cattle or 50, 75 head of sheep.
And Dr. Temple, I got to ask you, who taught you to be such a good saleswoman? You are good. We're going to be right back with Dr. Temple Grumman and working with farm animals. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Oldson.
We are back for more What's Eating What with Dr. Temple Grandin, professor of animal science at the Cal State University, Fort Collins, Colorado. Also the author of the brand new book, Working with Farm Animals. And Dr. Temple is right. It's filled with beautiful photographs and diagrams and everything else to help us learn how to think like an animal so we could better work with animals. And you know, I guess if we are to start thinking like animals, it would help us to know that all animals are either predator or prey. Fair to say, Dr.
That's
Temple?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And then from that, we can start recognizing behavior patterns.
Well, the first thing I always want people to do is be more observant of their animals. You know, what is it looking at? Now, what is it pointing its ears at? It's also important for people to understand the signs of fear that show when your animal is getting upset, because these can be warnings before he kicks you or does something dangerous. Okay, if you're working with cattle, for example, tail switching when there's no flies around is a first sign that the animal is getting upset. Same thing with horses. First sign before they kick. You know, then you'll get pooping because you're scaring the you-know-what out of them. And when you see the whites of their eyes, then your animal's really upset. You know, the more temperamental animals, they'll be the ones that stand in the back of the group, have the head way up. That's the animal that'll be more flighty, more likely to get startled if it suddenly sees something like a flag or a balloon or something like that.
And with respect to the herd animals in a field, they have specific patterns too of behavior too. When they see predator, the first thing they do is look up, right?
Well, they'll look up. You see, vision is the dominant sense, and they're extremely sensitive to little things that move rapidly. I've done a lot of work with the meatpacking plants, and one time I was in a plant and there was just a paper towel hanging out of the holder. And that about stopped everything. And just recently, I was at a plant over in Ireland, and there were some holes in the in a door, and the cattle could see some motion through the holes. And we stuck tape over the holes, and that greatly improved the handling. Little things that move rapidly are things they tend to pay attention to, because out in the wild, those are things that would be the dangerous things. And when animals see a predator, they sometimes will flock together, kind of a loose bunch. Cattle can graze in loose bunches. And when they really get upset, they get into milling. And that's a behavior you never want to see when you're working with animals, because they're really, really frightened. They'll just go round and round, all stuck together. The strongest animals pushing themselves in the middle of the mill. And that's a behavior that good stock people never want to see, that behavior.
The strongest work their way to the middle?
That's right. And because then the predator gets the weak ones on the outside of the milling mob.
And there you go. And that's how the strong stay strong, I guess.
Well, yeah. And I don't. You want to avoid that when you're handling cattle. You absolutely do not want to see that.
You made a comment, the strong are not always the leaders of the herd.
That's right. That's correct, because when the whole herd is moving, a lot of those strong animals stay more in the middle. And the animal that tends to be the leader is not the boss cow. It's just kind of a curious cow that's not quite as fearful, will be the leader. See, the thing about a new experience is something new is attractive if the animal can voluntarily approach. And there's a picture in the book of a cow approaching a cat laying in the grass. It's something novel. And this was just a regular house cat, not a mountain lion. And something novel is scary if you suddenly shove it in their face. So if you want to get your horse or your cow accustomed to things like flags and blooms, one of the best ways to do that is decorate the pasture fence with flags and allow your animal to walk up to it on his own. Don't shove it in their face. New things are both scary and attractive. They're attractive if the animal voluntarily approaches, and they're scary if you just shove it in their face and they can't get away from it.
And it's all on their own time that really counts.
That's right.
And, you know, when you put something, I've noticed the behavior often myself, is something new, they'll look at it, and some cattle will approach it, others will not.
That's right. You see, that's your individual differences. You know, some animals are more bold, lower fear than other animals. We did some of the very early research on cattle temperament, and we found that the animals that get really scared and jump around in the squeeze chute, or when you're holding them in it for vaccinations, are going to be the animals that have less weight gain because they get scared more easily. Another thing that research has shown very clearly is good stockmanship matters. When people like their animals, they're more productive. When animals are afraid of people, this has been very well researched in pigs by Paul Hemsworth, they're afraid of people, you have lower production. You know, people that like working with animals tend to get better producing animals. Stockmanship really, really does matter.
And that takes me to the difference between farm animals and domestic animals.
Well, the main difference is we've bred the dog to be hyper-social, to really want to please us and be a very social animal. That's one of the basic differences. Also, domestic animals tend to be lower fear. You know, as a breed, domestic cattle or species are calmer than the original, you know, wild cattle were. You know, we've bred some of the flightiness out of them. It's not like they're from another planet. It's kind of a continuum, because our domestic animals still have hardwired behaviors, like fighting by butting with their heads for sheep and cattle, and horses rear up and they flail at each other. But even on the sheep and cattle, it's different. They back up and then do it, where cattle just tend to push.
And I guess, you know, when it comes to thinking like an animal, those of us who have been through like 4-H and whatnot,
yes,
probably have the opportunity to start thinking like an animal before most other people. But also,
right,
4-H kids are taught that there is such a thing as a farm animal, and they're
That's
not
right.
a pet.
And I was in 4-H, and I think it's a real shame today we have some kids growing up in an animal-free world. I did a book signing one time for one of my other books, Animals Make Us Human, and I found out that 25% of the young families in South Denver, in a good part of town, had no animal, because I was at this Costco store, and they'd walk by me at the book table, and I'd approach them, and I'd just come up to them, and I told them, I was a professor of animal science, do you have pets? And the families with young kids, I was shocked to find out that about 20-25% of these families. No gerbil, no bird, no dog, no cat. These kids were growing up with absolutely no pets and no animals of any kind. I thought it was a real shame.
And how are they supposed to start thinking like animals if they have no contact at all with animals?
Well, and, I think it's a real big problem. Kids aren't getting enough contact with the natural world. I can remember as a child, we would just play out in the fields and just had a great time.
And is it? I suppose it's really easy for them to become vegetarians if they've never had contact with animals, period, but with farm animals, those animals that we work with, it would be very easy to become a vegetarian under those circumstances.
Well, the problem is, the thing that worries me today is we've got so many kids growing up totally separated from the world of the practical. They don't So now you're a cooking show, so I think, people have a hunger.
Can you hold on to that, Dr. Temple? We have to take a quick break, right back with Dr. Temple Grandin, NU, 831-479-1080.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are living in a different world than we lived, only a few generations ago. When I was growing up, close to the wild, wild west there in Montana, we were pretty brusque in the way we moved our cattle, but Dr. Temple Grandin came along and said, stop being so brusque. Stop yelling.
Well, and I think people are getting a whole lot better in how they're moving their animals. Also, I was just listening to the advertisement that was just on. I think there's a real hunger in young people today to get back with the land, and that's why there's interest in things like slow food movement. They miss it. And they want to get back to doing things.
But don't you think we've, in the industrialization of our agriculture, we've essentially taken all those kids off the land and parked them in the cities where they don't have much to do? How can they get back?
One of the things I've observed, I travel all around the rural areas. I was just up in Vermont. And you travel through the small towns in Vermont, they seem much more vibrant and lively. You get into some of the small towns in the far west, you're seeing a lot of boarded up stores. Young people are moving out. But I know a lot of millennials in the city now, probably don't like that term, I probably should not have used it. Younger people in the cities, there's a hunger to get back with the land. And I think that's a really good thing to be doing. And I think one of the worst things our schools did is take out all the hands-on classes, cooking, sewing, woodworking, art, theater, because also these kinds of classes can make really good careers. That gets into a whole other subject of things that I talk about. And I think it's good that young people want to get back with the natural world.
Is agriculture one way they can get back? Is there a place in modern agriculture for them now?
Well, the thing that, reason we do modern agriculture is it's very efficient. Now, I got to doing a lot of thinking about, big. A lot of people think big is bad. Well, I've been on big dairies that actually had very good stockmanship, and I've been on dairies that were terrible. I've been on good big and bad big and bad small and good small. But one of the things about big supply chain things, they're very fragile. Let's look at something like electricity distribution. I was listening to a show last night on NPR about hacking the power grid. And big things are very, very efficient, but they're fragile. They're very easy to disrupt. Last year, there was a shipping strike on the Hanjin, not a shipping strike, a shipping bankruptcy with one of the big shipping companies. And all the Christmas presents were sailing around on a container ship, and they couldn't unload them. Well, one thing we can be thankful for is that we're not dependent on that sort of on container ships for food. There's other places in the world that are dependent on that sort of thing. And, things that are big, they're very efficient, cheap food. But the problem is they're fragile. They're very easy. They can be disrupted extremely easily.
You speak of fragile, and one of the things I just read in the Wall Street Journal here last week or so, story of chickens and how we've selected chickens for their big breasts so long that the chickens are now stopping procreation. They're not making baby chickens anymore.
Well, this is a problem. There's a trade-off when you breed. And if you just breed for production, you tend to lose on reproduction and on disease resistance. Everything takes energy. Nothing is free. And now what some of the breeders are doing, they've realized that they've got to back off just a little bit on the growth and breed for some of these other important traits like disease resistance and reproduction. The same problems happened in the dairy cow. She's been bred to make milk, and it's difficult to get the cow to breed back. I actually have a term for that. I call it biological system overload. And there's a point where you push the biology too hard, and then you're going to have problems.
And
I read that article, too.
Yeah, it was pretty sad, you know.
We can have great chicken and cheap chicken,
but it is fragile, and it is vulnerable, and it can break. Well,
the other thing I got to thinking about, if we go back totally to the older type chickens, it's going to take 25% more feed to feed those chickens. That doesn't look so good from the sustainability standpoint. So maybe a more sensible thing to do is back off a little bit, and maybe you take a 6 or 7% hit on the feed conversion. So you take 7 to 8% more feed, not 25% more feed.
And maybe you'll have a chicken there to survive.
Well, yes. And they actually... You know, it's amazing how fast they grow. But I think we have to start looking at what is the optimal thing to do. I mean, you get a dairy cow giving out so much milk that she only lasts for 2 years. That's not even financially sustainable because it takes you 2 years to grow that heifer into a cow. I don't think these places have got their costing done right. The more sensible approach has been taken by Fair Oaks Dairy outside of Chicago, and I think it's a really good big dairy. It's open to the public. And the cow now is going for 3 or 4 lactations instead of just 2, and they're breeding a smaller cow. So you have efficiency, but you're not overloading the system. I think there's a place for both, decent large-scale commercial and people getting back with the land and doing all the things I've been hearing on the advertising in this show. There's a place for both kinds of markets.
There's both worlds. Well, my notion is that things are getting very, very big and very, very small. And it's kind of the people in the middle that are having a tough time.
Oh, I know it. I think it's sort of like the beer market. I've been following the craft beer market.
Exactly.
And here in Fort Collins, we've got a huge amount of little small breweries. And then you've got the great big, huge big boys.
Yep.
And I think it's a problem. One of the biggest problems, I think, now for people that want to get started in farming is getting land. That is a problem.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, our last break. But when we come back, I want to ask Dr. Temple for some tips on how we can start thinking more like animals, whether we have pets, whether we have small farm animals or whatnot. How can we start thinking like animals so we can be more humane in how we treat our animals? Right back.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get 2 friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get 2 friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is 2 numbers. 1 is 2, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge 2 local bucks each day. Get 2 others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We have a few more minutes with Dr. Temple Grandin. Has a wonderful new book out, Working with Farm Animals. A great read. If you love animals, you'll love this book. And I just opened it up last night, read the whole thing just like that. It was like, wow, what fun. And informative. And it teaches you how to move animals by thinking like,
well, the first thing, as I mentioned before, you've got to get away from verbal language and think about what is it, seeing? Like, I saw an animal that got terrified of a black hat because it was abused by a person wearing a black hat. A white hat was fine. Visual memory is very specific. When you think in words, you tend to overgeneralize. The other thing I want to mention...
Wait a minute. How does that work? When you think with words, you tend to overgeneralize.
Well, I'll have someone come up to me and say, my horse is crazy, what do I do about it? Well, I don't have any idea what I'm going to do about a crazy horse because I don't know what the horse did.
Okay, there you go.
Or a crazy dog. I have people ask me that kind of stuff all the time. What's a crazy dog do? Now I'm visualizing all happy and wiggly and jumping on me, or snarly and biting and nasty. Both of that, both nasty and nice, could be a crazy dog. I don't even know how to begin to help the person on their behavior problem until I know what the dog did. And right. I can ask those kind of questions all the time.
So by having that picture of it.
Well, I'm now seeing a very specific fluffy corgi that's very happy jumping on me for the crazy happy. And I'm seeing a very nasty dog that was in a hotel room for the snarly.
There you go.
That we were deciding whether or not we could... have this dog move down to the office, and he was way too nasty to that. The other thing that people need to understand is animals do have emotions. And in the book, I discuss the Penscap seven emotional systems that all mammals have. Fear. Human beings and animals have fear. Anger. Then you have separation distress. You know, you leave the dog home alone, or you wean the lambs and they're blah, blah, blah. That separation distress, that's a separate emotional system from fear. And then you have seek. Some animals are high seeker. Like one dog's going to want to chase the ball, and the other Labrador could care less about the ball and makes a great service animal. And one's a low seek, the other's a high seek. Then, of course, you have sex, and then you have the mother-young nurturing. That's the oxytocin system. And then you have play. And these genetics can affect the strength or the weakness of each one of these emotional traits. You know, like Labrador Retrievers, for example. One's really frisky and wants to ball chase, and the other one could care less about it. That's just a personality.
And that's the way of it. Now, just a minute left. What is Dr. Temple Grandin's favorite animal?
Well, I really like cattle. I really, you know, beef cattle, I really like them a whole lot. They're the animal that I've worked the most with. But I mean, I like all animals. And each animal has got, you know, different personality. Just think about it in the terms of the seven Penscap emotional systems, and they're explained in the book.
Mm-hmm. So they're emotional animals. They're fearful animals.
Absolutely, animals have emotions. They got the same emotional drivers in the base of the brain that we've got. The difference between a human being and an animal is the size of the cortex. Animals are not going to fly a rocket ship to the moon. They're not going to write Beethoven's symphony. There's a complexity.
But they're going to live in love, right?
They can live in love, yes. Yes, they definitely can. And they have emotions. And to say they don't have emotions is stupid. And I wrote some of the first papers.
Ran out of time. But working with animals, Dr. Temple Grandin, Grandin.com. Get the book. You'll love it. Thank you, Dr. Temple.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.